Happy Independence Day. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, July 4th, 2019. And this is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, we consider one of the enduring features of our country, the land itself. In a bit, Jared Phillips, author of the book Hipbillies, Deep Revolution in the Arkansas Ozarks, we'll discuss how a few decades of unprecedented development in northwest Arkansas has changed the landscape here. A reminder that we continue the holiday approach to our program tomorrow on Ozarks as we celebrate music, our annual early July tradition of listening again to some of our favorite in-studio performances from the first 6 months of the year. Antoinette Grajeda and Timothy Dennis will join me for a holiday edition mixtape featuring great music recorded right here at the Carver Center for Public Radio. That's tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3, and again, Sunday morning at 9 on Weekend Ozarks at Large on KUAF. The next First Friday Flicks at Lawrence Plaza is tomorrow night in downtown Bentonville. This month's featured film is Lego Movie 2. The movie is scheduled to start tomorrow night at 8:30. It's hosted by Friends of Bentonville Parks and Recreation. This is Ozarks at Large. For this 4th of July edition, we're considering landscape as we listen to a few conversations and stories previously aired on our show. We'll begin with the science behind understanding what a great part of the United States used to be like when bison roamed the western half of the nation in great numbers. Last November, Leland Bemet came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. We know that when native populations thousands of years ago gathered for a social event, bison probably was what was for dinner. Part of what we know about the relationship between bison and humans thousands of years ago is through research done by Dr. Leland Bemet. He's with the Oklahoma Archaeological Survey, and last fall, he was on the University of Arkansas campus to deliver a Stigler lecture in anthropology and archaeology. He first started researching bison and bison hunting in 1980, at a site called Bonfire, where large piles of bison bones could be studied thousands of years after the animals had been run off a cliff. He says the bison is a herd animal, making mass kills for big feasts easier. He says hunters, over time, understood bison behaviors and would build arroyos, or ditches, to trap them. Leland Bemet says one of the questions still unanswered is just how many bison once roamed North America.
That's one of the questions that we've been trying to figure out, because at that point we had the extinction of mammoths and mastodons and camels and horses. A lot of these are plains, grassland animals, herd animals, and so they're in direct competition with the bison. So we have a lot of paleontological finds where you have bone beds, and bison are not much of a component of that. It's mostly horses and camels and all these others. You get some bison, they're there. But then with the extinction of that competition, bison's what's left. And so at that point, bison flourish. But bison almost went extinct. They were under the same extinction pressures as all of the other animals. And on the North American plains, bison were, their populations probably started out pretty good and then dwindled way down and almost went extinct. But probably they were mobile enough that there were little enclaves off of the plains. We don't know if it was in Mexico or where the enclaves were, but after the major extinction events, bison came back to the plains and they took off.
Can the work that you do help us understand the evolution not only of the bison population but of the hunting techniques that were used to feed people?
It does. That's kind of mainly what I'm interested in, is seeing how the development of these hunting techniques came about and why. And part of what we see, at least on the southern plains, is that these large-scale kills are taking place at a particular season of the year. And in this instance, it's the late summer, early fall is when we see these herds being killed off en masse, so what we call a large-scale or a communal kill. But for the rest of the year, then the same groups are dividing off into little family groups and hunting bison at a small scale. They're just killing one or two at a time because, one, a family is not large enough to conduct one of these large arroyo kills. Mm-hmm. And so then they're just, you know, encountering a bison along at a watering hole, and they ambush it and butcher it all up. But then at certain times of the year, people are coming together for social reasons. Everybody around the world forever has been, you know, we're very much a social animal. And so we have aggregations where large groups come together, and you have to feed large groups of people. And so they normally have those aggregations when there's a period of easy to get food. So you have a surplus either of plants, you know, nuts, something comes into season, or a fish run happens. In this case, it's the bison that at certain seasons of the year, what we're starting to understand is that the bison are migrating through a region. And so these early hunters are intercepting the bison as they're moving through an area where they want to be meeting other family members, other groups for other social things, and you need to feed them. Well,
here's the feast.
Here it is. And let's send every able-bodied person that we have out there to conduct one of these large-scale kills, and then we have a surplus of meat for feeding everybody for a month or a couple weeks, however long this aggregation is.
Any can you tell when you go to a place like Bonfire and you have all these bones, any idea how many animals might be killed in one of these mass killings? Can you get an estimate?
Sure. And we spend a lot of time analyzing the bison bones just for that reason. We want to know the season of the kill. We want to know what the makeup of the herd is, and the age of the animals, the sex of the animals, and how many there are. And so with the large kills at Bonfire, they probably were running 200 animals off the cliff time.
And then would butcher them there?
And butcher them. Well, when you're looking at a bison that weighs almost, you know, 1,800 pounds, you don't just pick him up and haul him anywhere. So, yes, you're going to do at least the initial butchering there. You may just flay off the meat and take that somewhere else. But picking up and moving even our modern animals is not easy. And we're talking animals that are 20 to 25% larger than modern bison.
Is there any way through research you can tell if there was other aspects of the relationship with bison other than just food? I mean, spiritual or respect or?
There is, and a lot of this we can see it easier in the more historic groups that are hunting bison on the northern plains, you know, up in Canada. You know, when we have Europeans come through and they are doing the fur trade and they witness Native Americans getting together and making a large-scale kill, and they can see the rituals that go along with that, that there's all this dancing and feasting and curing ceremonies and honoring people that have passed since the last time they got together. So there's all that social aspect, and bison is very much part of that. You'll see that a bison skull, is often the centerpiece of any ceremony that goes on, or at least a lot of them. Now, it gets a little more difficult when you try to take what we can see historically and take that back in time, because we can't see the feast. We can't see the dancing. We don't, you know, our crystal ball isn't that clear. But what we do have are inklings of things that are going on. And one of those is we came up with at the Cooper site in northwest Oklahoma as one of our arroyo-style kills. And at the very dead end point of that arroyo, there was a painted bison skull. And this is 10,500 years ago. So that means the amount of planning that went into this kill site ahead of time was that these people were there. They brought in, they selected a bison skull from a previous kill event, positioned it at the head of that gully, painted it, and then conducted the kill on top of that. So the herd that came in on top of it crushed that skull. Mm. And so that's why it was still there. But this is very similar to what we see in historically, where prior to a kill event, there would be a ceremony they would call a bison calling ceremony. And it would oftentimes include a painted skull or painted stones that were positioned right at the entryway to a corral type system. We call it a pound. And the herd then is run up over that. And oftentimes those skulls are destroyed, but their power is in attracting the animals. If the kill isn't successful, then you can sit there and say, well, obviously our ceremony didn't have enough power, or the skull or this rock didn't have any power. You leave it behind because you don't want to use that again. It didn't have any power.
Gotcha.
But in this case, it did function in what it was supposed to do, and a herd came in and it was trampled, and so that they left the pieces there, of course, because you can't use it again. You make a new ceremony.
I know that so much of, well, everything that you do in your research involves physical evidence and carbon dating and things like that. You mentioned the crystal ball. Do you ever allow yourself, not professionally, but just personally, to think about that crystal ball and what it might have looked like, what it might have sounded like if you're taking them into these ditches, these arroyos, and having a mass kill?
You have to a certain extent. I mean, that's not something that you can publish. But right. On the other hand, it is, because it's that intuition of you have to couch everything that our archaeology is doing and getting evidence as we are recreating that physical space around that site. And so we want to know, what did this gully really look like? What acoustics ability go on? I mean, you know, you get that many animals jammed into an area today, and all hell breaks loose.
The adrenaline that's going on between animal and human.
Exactly. And so it helps to have, you know, you have to sit back and contemplate and say, all right, if I'm part of this activity that's going on here, what am I seeing? Where, after a kill event, where am I going to go in here to butcher these animals? You have to have space to be able to do that. So where are people standing? What, you know, and so we are, in a sense, creating in our minds this view of what activities are taking place and how those activities are distributed around these animals in this event. And in a sense, creating this kind of dark crystal ball.
Chances are, by the time you leave this planet, you won't have all those answers.
No.
Is that okay?
Oh, absolutely.
Not frustrating?
You know, there's a lot of fun out there to be had in answering the questions that we do get answers to. And, you know, is it frustrating not to know everything? Well, you know, people before me didn't know everything, so they left me questions to be able to deal with. And this is part of the excitement that I have in teaching at the university, having students, is you can instill these little seeds. Here's the important questions that we are chipping away at, but we don't have the answers. And you present that to where they look at it and go, oh, that's intriguing. That sounds like fun. I want to do that. And so I think it's more satisfying to realize that people are going to continue working on these questions.
I think for most of us, other than maybe the eagle, the buffalo seems to be the most American of animals. You think that's deserved?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I might be a little biased, just a little.
Yeah.
But it is the icon of the American West, has been at least ever since, you know, any Europeans that ever came out to the American West, the bison, that is the emblem for it. And when we look at, you know, the Native Americans back to 11,000 years ago and see how ingrained in their culture bison were, they would have to agree, I would think. You know, are there other animals that are important to them? Of course. But at least for the plains, that is an animal that could provide them with more food than they knew what to do with on a regular basis, and that's got to be important.
Finally, have you had bison?
Oh, yes.
What's your favorite way to have it?
Oh, I just cut off a chunk and throw it over the charcoal.
But you don't have to take it into a mass kill area.
You know, not so much.
Right. We've got it a bit easier.
The taking on one bison, and we do this with our field schools sometimes where someone will donate a bison to us where we can butcher it. And you learn right away how much meat you really get. You know, when you're looking at 400 pounds worth of meat off of one animal, and that's enough to feed 15 students in our field school for 6 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of meat. That's a, you know, and that's in the portions that we eat it, and that they're probably much reduced compared to
right to
what they did, but still, that's a lot of meat. But one of the reasons we do this is, now you go over here to our site that we are excavating where they killed 20 animals.
And imagine.
How much meat came out of that? How much work went into that? And it finally, you know, the light bulbs come on, and all of a sudden they start thinking and go, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Leland Bemet is with the Oklahoma Archaeological Survey, and last November he was on the University of Arkansas campus to deliver a Stigler lecture in anthropology and archaeology. During his visit, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. For this holiday, we're considering landscape with previously aired stories and interviews. Just ahead, how major growth and development has altered Northwest Arkansas.
Alternative and indie pop bands Young the Giant and Fits in the Tantrums will perform at the Walmart Amp in Rogers Wednesday, July 10th. Gates open at 6 p.m. with opening act Coin starting at 8. Tickets now available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
This is Ozarks at Large for the 4th of July, 2019. On our show this holiday, we're considering land and landscapes, and we continue with a conversation that aired this past March. Landscapes in Northwest Arkansas seem to be altered every day. Development follows the continued increase in population. Last year, the Northwest Arkansas Council projected that by sometime this year, the Northwest Arkansas Metro would crack the list of the 100 most populous metro areas in the country. Based on population estimates, Northwest Arkansas could be slipping by cities like Youngstown, Ohio, and Modesto, California, right about now. We do know that between 2010 and 2017, population here grew by more than 16%. That kind of growth means more houses, more apartments, and more buildings are constructed, which can mean a reduction in rural land and farms. Jared Phillips notices such changes. He and his wife are farmers in Washington County, and both are multi-generational Ozarkers. He's an assistant professor of international studies at the University of Arkansas, and he's also author of the book Hipbillies, Deep Revolution in the Arkansas Ozarks. He says there are numbers that can begin to explain how the land in Northwest Arkansas has shifted.
You know, in Madison County in 1950, 80% of the county was considered farmland.
80%?
80% of the county, according to the USDA Ag Census, was considered to be productive agricultural land. And that statistic varies a little bit depending on the county in the Ozarks and you know, down into the, you know, the upper, the Ouachitas and the other mountain counties kind of in Arkansas. But we, you know, our you know, my aunt tells me stories of you know, my grandfather hitching up a team to the wagon and going out to the field. And my grandmother worked in town, and he would be taking care of her while he was taking care of the farm. And he would set her on a blanket underneath a tree, and he would take care of the crop and come check on her and, you know, and all those things. So, yeah.
Some statistics you provided me in farms in the Ozarks. Mm. In 1950, more than 37,500 farms.
Yeah.
Average farm size, over 135 acres.
That seems about right, yeah.
Okay. By 2012, just over 16,000 farms. So it's been reduced by half.
Yeah.
Average size
has increased.
Increased. Mm-hmm. So fewer farms, but each one's bigger.
Yeah, and that's not just an Ozark story, right? That's a national story. Anywhere we look around, we're going to see a similar story. I think what made my wife and I start to pay real close attention to it around here is that we have the Ozarks. We have a really marginal ground in some cases. I mean, we love it. It's beautiful. You know, we have things like the buffalo and the national forest and all that. But we forget that the farm, as far as arable land, good farmland, we just don't have that much of it. And a lot of that land happens to also coincide with where the development happens. So housing development, industrial development, things like that. And those two things can't exist very well together. And so what we've seen is, for those same statistics that you were just talking about, we've seen a 30% on average reduction in the amount of land that's farmed across the Ozarks. That statistic holds true for Washington and Benton County as well. And same for Carroll County. Madison County, the statistic, there's a little bit of a higher loss. They had such a higher percentage to start with. We've seen a pretty significant reduction in not just in the amount of farmland that's being farmed, and not just even the number of farmers that are on the farms, but in the number of farms that are being able to sustain past one generation. So this multi-generational thing which is part of the mythos of farming, especially small and mid-sized farming, is just simply more and more problematic. It's not impossible. Happens, you know, we have neighbors that are multi-generational farmers. To see a family on the same piece of ground for more than one or two generations is becoming quite rare nationally, not just here.
You use the word sustain. Does that mean it is financially difficult to sustain?
There are a lot of factors that go into it. I can't speak for the large farms.
Sure.
That's not my experience. But I mean, I know some of the basic national statistics. And so when we think about these things, we know that agriculture – since the New Deal and since the increasing mechanization of agriculture, it's required a higher financial outlay to run all the machinery, to purchase all the inputs that are needed, be it chemical inputs or you know, new fencing supplies or new types of technology to more efficiently manage your farm. And that, in part, is needed because as the labor has left the farm, those who have remained on farms have needed, if they wanted to stay, they had to become more efficient. One person had to do more with less. And so these were really wonderful and needed innovations. And that's a story that is not uncommon to the United States. Every farming community, you know, you look at Britain, you look at France, you look in India and China, it's a similar kind of story. I think what's difficult about Arkansas and at least about the Ozarks is that since the 1970s and 80s, really, we've seen a massive increase in migration. And there are lots of different ways that we can talk about the in-migration, and in some of my stuff I've worked on that before with Back to the Land community. But what we've seen recently has, because of the economic benefit that things like Walmart and Tyson and the University of Arkansas and others have given the region, these are wonderful benefits. They've insulated us. They've helped us to prosper and do things like protect Mount Kessler and other things that are really wonderful for the community. They've also made it harder for farmers to keep a hold of land and for young and beginning farmers to buy land because development prices have skyrocketed mm-hmm. compared to the actual value of farmland, what the land would be worth if you were just going to farm it.
And you go back that Northwest Arkansas and the Ozarks, not every piece of land is good for farming.
Right.
Hardscrabble,
right.
That sort of thing. And to reiterate what you said, much of the great farming land is also great development
mm-hmm.
land.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are Fortune 500 companies here. The student population of the University of Arkansas has doubled. There's Northwest Arkansas. I mean, there are just a lot more things. Is there a happy medium here?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. I know that there are a lot of really wonderful people that are working on the Northwest Arkansas Land Trust has recently become really interested in preserving farmland. In my conversations with people as I go around the region and ask different questions about things like this, I think that there are people that are interested in finding that happy medium because – development on one hand is a really good thing, but development and growth for the sake of these things is akin to kind of a cancer. It'll just burn itself out and take everything else with it. And I think especially with conversations around institutions like the Buffalo River or Mount Kessler even or other kind of hallmark spaces, I think what we've begun to learn and begun to see is kind of an old lesson in American life that farmland can provide a really useful buffer zone, both to control the rate of movement between urban and rural, but also as a protective medium. Because all farmers want to take care of their land. They all want to do the right thing ecologically and environmentally. And in so doing, they provide a really needed and useful buffer between sort of wild and not wild, if you will.
Kessler has been preserved. It's, mm-hmm. it's a great recreation space, but it's not farmland.
No. Not every place in the – I don't think that necessarily every place needs to be preserved as a farm. I think more places should stay as farms than are currently staying as farms. But I think that there are going to always be spaces where, for whatever reason, they've been removed from the farming economy, like Kessler was, mm-hmm. Or Devil's Den or things like that, for so long that it would be hard to bring them back into productive agricultural use, if for no other reason than they've become overgrown again, or the land just needed that because it was such a tenuous spot anyways. It needed this long period of regeneration.
Northwest Arkansas has grown mm-hmm. dramatically in the last 25 or 30 years. You see it in Bentonville, you see it in Fayetteville, Springdale, and Rogers. But I think where it really hits home is when you go to Centerton. Mm-hmm. Or Prairie Grove, mm-hmm. or Farmington. Mm-hmm. Those used to be pretty rural communities, mm-hmm. and now you see McDonald's and, apartment complexes and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, Prairie Grove is a subway. We've had it for a while, but, I think what I see more is, I remember when Farmington used to be separate from Fayetteville, and these mm-hmm. days it...
And then separate from Prairie Grove on
right,
the other side.
Yeah. And there's still a separation between Farmington and Prairie Grove a little bit when you drive through. It's less and less every year. But I see it more outside of the sort of the formal incorporated township. I see it more in the unincorporated space. So when you go out, instead of like staying on Highway 62 and following yourself all the way through into Prairie Grove, you see it if you take Bethel Blacktop out. When you get out of the official city limits and you start to see where even 5 or 6 years ago there were very few houses, very few developments. Now subdivisions are popping up very quickly. They're outside of any planning scope, so there's not much regulation in the way of lot size, how these things should be aligned according to watersheds, and there's little incentive to work with things like the Illinois River Watershed Alliance and stuff like that. And so what we've seen is a lot of beautiful, productive farms that are well cared for. Somebody will die, there'll be financial trouble or something like that. Things that are normal in the scope of just life and farming. A developer who's willing to pay far more than the land is really worth will come in and buy it. And then the next thing you know, it's chopped up into small acreage lots and you get a new subdivision.
What kind of public discussion can there be about that? Because if I'm someone who owns this mm-hmm. once was farmland and someone offers me, a small fortune.
Yeah.
I mean, okay.
That's a great question.
As college tuition goes up, maybe I'm thinking about my kids or my grandkids.
Yeah, I've got two boys, and I want them to go to school. And it's a powerful question to try to understand. I think a couple of things... A couple of things that are useful would be really for a conversation to occur at the county and the state level. Mm-hmm. When we first really started, my wife and I, when we first started becoming very active about trying to understand what was happening here and trying to figure out who in the county to talk to, my wife spent a lot of time looking around at the nation and trying to understand what were other regions' approaches to this issue. And one of the things she came across was this really interesting group called the American Farmland Trust. And what my wife, Lindy, told me was that when you look at the Farmland Trust and at the data that they have pulled over the last 30 years or so, for every dollar of functional – or for every – excuse me, for every every acre of functional farmland that's outside of an incorporated township that exists, the county will spend, county government will spend about 30 some odd cents to provide services for that acre. So they'll make 60 some odd cents on that, you know. But for every acre of farmland that is turned into a housing development, still outside of the city, but just then the city will, or excuse me, then the county will have to spend $1.16 for every dollar that they bring in off of that. And so I think at a really basic level, this is what my, you know, my wife is telling me all this stuff, and she just said, this is simple math. Like the county budget officers need to say, oh, we lose money every time productive farmland goes. Not, this isn't even a cultural conversation or environmental conversation. This is in Washington County, our county has budget problems. Well, a place to begin having this conversation would be to say, how do we understand development in the rural spaces more effectively so that we don't lose money hand over fist?
You know, for a lot of people, that's going to be counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me? This development means more property taxes, better for the schools, things like that.
Right, except that a lot of those children are going into the urban towns, right? So, like, my kids go to Prairie Grove School District, but I pay taxes as far as the county is concerned. We pay a little bit of property taxes that go into the Prairie Grove District, but all there's in the 1970s, an economist named Michael Lipton came up with this thesis called the urban bias thesis, right? And it's a wonderful thesis because it's really quick to say I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying, when we have an aggregation of people in a particular place, an urban space, most of the resources and the attention goes to those places to the detriment of those who live outside of that. And so even if those people experience a net loss in services, a net loss in environmental protections or policy attention or anything like that, it balances out because the majority of the people live in an urban space, right? Or a semi-urban space. Well, that's all fine and good if you live in the urban space. But if you live in the rural space, that's having to deal with the fact that we have worsening road conditions because we have all this increased development that's happening out there. We have less of an ability to rely on an already overtaxed county sheriff system who is because of their limited staffing and shrinking budgets, they're unable to adequately respond to the calls that they get across the county. Because while Washington County, you know, we have Fayetteville, we have Springdale, it's still a big county and it's still got a lot of rural space. And Sheriff Helder does not have, you know, 100 deputies that he can call on to go and patrol every corner of the county, you know.
Well, and then you have this shifting of population where let's say in 1980, Fayetteville and Springdale had a combined population of, I don't know, 65 or 70,000.
Yeah, I guess it sounds about right.
Roughly,
yeah.
I don't know. Now each is bigger than that. Mm-hmm. So representation on quorum courts and things like that, there are far more people in what we would call the cities or the urban areas than the rural areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in the rural areas, so we're in Quorum Court District 7 for Washington County, and I don't remember our Quorum Court member's name, but he lives in Fayetteville town proper. He does not live where the bulk of his constituency geographically, not population-wise, but geographically live, right? And the same is true for the way our state House representatives work, right? So we have Representative Fight, who lives down in Crawford County, is my representative, even though I live way up and, all over an hour away from where she is. And so there's this because of how districting lines have been drawn, it makes it really difficult to see an adequate voice for rural spaces to come in and ask for things like, well, how do we reapportion the money, the money that that the county brings in to effectively, deal with our issues? How do we think about things like changing the nature of property tax structure to where some states like Washington State, Pennsylvania, and others have got property tax structures that will allow for working agricultural land to receive different kinds of benefits. So maybe a percentage reduction for every percentage for certain amounts of percentage in their income that comes from the farm, or things like that, to where it makes it easier for farm families that are right on the line to stay, in the region. And so somebody who makes 100% of their income off of the farm should receive a particular kind of incentive, property tax reward or whatever the case may be, largely a reduction, especially as development pressure, artificially inflates land value.
Is part of the equation here people who grew up in rural areas, many of us didn't want to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's move to a bigger place and enjoy the amenities there. do not have a desire to continue to live in a small town of 300 mm-hmm. or 400 people.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, I would argue that they actually could be populations like that could actually be some of the greatest allies. Mm. If by ally I'm talking about somebody who wants to come alongside and help to work with farmers to find in farming communities to find a happy medium. Because I'm not saying that there shouldn't be housing developments. Right. People, even an area like north of Arkansas, and we have what 35, 32 people a day moving in. The rural space is going to be developed. We don't have a, you know, no matter how much of a, like a, I'm a historian, so no matter how much I want to go backwards into the past, I can't do that, right? But I think people that come from small towns and from rural spaces are really an important ally because they understand the value maybe more directly than imports that are coming, you know, from the immigrants that are coming in from LA or San Francisco or Chicago or whomever, who have a particular vision of what a beautiful and rural space should look like, which is why they're coming here. We are a beautiful, wonderful, almost idyllic space. But there's a because perhaps they're so far removed mm-hmm. culturally or regionally from when their rural space was turned into an urban center that there's a loss of a perspective, if you will. Like, what do we need to do to preserve elements of this?
You're a historian, so you look backward.
I do look backward. Yeah.
Do you allow yourself to look forward, like 15 years from now, when your children are older, what this area will look like, what you want it to look like?
Yeah, I try to think in 50-year time brackets.
50?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason for that is really simple. It's because I'm lazy, and 50 years is a rounder number to me than 15. But also, the writer and essayist, or poet and essayist, Wendell Berry in Kentucky, and a colleague of his, Dr. Wes Jackson, who was the head of the Land Institute in Kansas, they came up with this idea called the 50-year farm bill, which is the current farm bill that we have is on a 5-year cycle. And their argument basically was that we as a community in the United States, we think too short-sighted. And that we need to think not in terms of 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, but really generational terms. So let's think about 50 years or 100 years at a time. So I try to look down the road a little bit. I'm really terrible at it. But,
well, it's not an easy thing to do.
Well, and I'm trained to look backwards. I'm not
right.
trained to look forwards. I try to look down the road 50 or 100 years and try to understand, well, with the onset of climate change and how it's beginning to impact Northwest Arkansas. So we're a whole growing zone warmer than we were when I was a kid. We don't, you know, I was telling my son the other day, we used to get snow that was, you know, 6-8 inches regularly.
1970s, man. It was, it seemed like we were out of school all the time.
Yeah, even into the 80s and 90s when I was in school. And, you know, I can't, 2008 and 9, that was our last truly awesome snow. So these things, these patterns of sort of long scale shifting make me kind of wonder, like, well, if we're talking as a community, as Northwest Arkansas is, about things like food security and how do we deal with meeting the needs of all members of our community, then I think farming has to become a part of that conversation. And I don't just mean the farming that we see at the farmer's market. I think the broader farming community writ large. And one of the things that when I talk to different people, and my wife and I talk to different people that are in the agricultural community, we kind of begin to see that there's a really weird split. You're either a farmer's market kind of farmer, mm-hmm. or the perception goes, right? Which
right.
is not true.
Right.
Or you're a Tyson kind of farmer, which is also not fair, right? Both types of agricultural institutions are really needed, I think. And what I want to see 50 years down the road is a community that can work between these two extremes of a pole. If we want to think of these as because extremes on a pole, right, or on a line. And I think that if we can figure out a way where we can have the more that traditional style of Ozark thinking, where we in the Ozarks we don't think big or small, we think middle of the road. You know,
yeah.
Like we want to do our thing, we want to like do it well enough, and generally be left alone, right? And so this is kind of the idea that I tend to think of. How do we adapt that idea to where the population projections are looking like they're going to take us, you know, because in the next decade or so, we're looking at being at 800,000 people between Benton and Washington County. And so how do we model our agricultural life, our broader cultural life to retain those elements of the past Ozarks for the future Ozarks?
Jared Phillips is a farmer, multi-generational Ozarker, assistant professor of international studies at the University of Arkansas, and author of the book, Hipbillies, Deep Revolution in the Arkansas Ozarks, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Our conversation first aired on Weekend Ozarks at Large in March.
Opera in the Ozarks presents its 69th season now through July 19th at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs. It features 22 performances of three fully staged operas, including La Boheme, Little Women, and The Abduction from the Seraglio, plus a Broadway cabaret at the Fayetteville Town Center and chamber music at Cooper Chapel in Bella Vista. Tickets and schedule at opera.org.
And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, July 4th, 2019. Happy Independence Day. Spending some time on this edition of Ozarks at Large considering land and landscapes. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art has two exhibitions, one indoor and one outdoor, that combine art and nature. Color Field is an outdoor sculpture exhibition developed by Associate Curator of Contemporary Art, Allison Glenn. The exhibit features artists who use lush colors and enlarged forms that are on display in the museum's North Forest and select locations in the museum through September 30th. The second exhibition, Nature's Nation, American Art and Environment, is located inside the museum. Developed by Princeton University Art Museum, the exhibit features 100 artworks and examines American artists' impact on shaping environmental understanding and stewardship. It's on view through September 9th. In May, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended a media preview for Nature's Nation, and at that time she filed this report.
Nature's Nation, American Art and Environment, was developed by Princeton University Art Museum. Carl Cusero, curator of American art at Princeton University Art Museum, co-curated the show. He says they're trying to tell a new story of American art by looking at the artwork in its environmental context.
What we've done is assemble 300 years plus, really, of American art that we look at in terms of how nature is represented, how the human interface with nature is represented. And this is all part of a method called eco-criticism, which is the sort of overarching method that we use in the exhibition. It's not a very friendly sounding name, perhaps, but really what it does is look at cultural artifacts, in this case visual culture, with an eye towards ecology, which is of course the study of the way living things relate to their environments.
Cusero says a real impetus for this approach has been where we find ourselves now globally in terms of environmental issues. Alan Braddock, a professor of art history and American studies at William & Mary and co-curator of this exhibition, describes it as 300 years of American artists helping to invent ecological consciousness.
How have artists been bearing witness to the changes in our environment for a long, long time? And more than just sort of showing us problems, they imagine solutions and they imagine the beauty that we should try to preserve.
The first section of the exhibit, The Order of Things, includes artworks from the 1700s through the early 1800s and reflects an early understanding of nature that places humans at the top of the hierarchy of life. One of the most striking paintings in this section is The Artist in His Museum by Charles Wilson Peel. The huge self-portrait commemorates his creation of the country's first public museum. As this painting shows, the museum contained thousands of specimens of flora and fauna displayed below portraits of elite male patriots and scientists. Braddock says Peel has organized the specimens according to the prevailing scientific system of the time that had been developed by Europeans.
But he also makes sure to point out the value of art by including his palette of paints and brushes. And so for Peel, art and science went hand in hand. And in some ways, that relationship is something we've forgotten over the years. And this work provides an important reminder that they need to come together, they need to reconnect. And more than ever now, as we face really daunting environmental challenges, the science and imagination need to go hand in hand in order to imagine a sustainable future.
An interesting foil to this piece, Braddock says, is a Native American woven robe from the Northwest Coast that was also produced in the early 19th century. He says it represents a Native American vision of order in nature.
Instead of specimens carefully arranged in rectangular display cases according to scientific taxonomies, the Native American artist has shown us a killer whale that was sacred to his community. And actually, I should say to her community, because men played an important role in the design of works like this, women executed them. And what's more, the orca or killer whale is composed of many, many, many other killer whales in the same image. You see a kind of accumulation of eyes and faces in that image, suggesting that from a Native American point of view, life forms in nature are all interconnected.
The second section of the exhibition examines the environmental consequences of settlement, industry, and war, with works from the mid-19th through early 20th century. It's here that the artwork focuses on the urban environment. Braddock says it's one thing to talk about rural places and wilderness, but it's another thing to talk about urban environments as having their own importance as places in which people live and have to survive.
And so the ecology of urban spaces becomes an important theme, and it also helps to introduce the important sub-theme of environmental justice, which runs as a kind of leitmotif through the exhibition. As Carl mentioned earlier, not everyone experiences an environment in the same way. Poor people, people of color, often women, have been marginalized in various places, in various contexts, and have not enjoyed the same environmental privileges as other Americans. And artists have been quite sensitive, and increasingly so in the 20th and 20th century, to those differences.
The third and final section, Nature's Vital Forms, features artwork from the 20th century to today. Artists here use bold colors and abstract shapes to underscore the human role in nature as an issue of practical and ethical concern. Crystal Bridges is the third and final venue for this exhibition. More information is available at crystalbridges.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And if you visit Crystal Bridges this holiday weekend, you may be able to take advantage of their new colorblind glasses. Last month, the museum unveiled 60 pairs of colorblind glasses, which can help some colorblind patrons see new colors and details when looking at the artwork. Guests can check out indoor or outdoor glasses that are sized for children or adults. There is also one fit-over pair that is designed for patrons who wear regular glasses. This is Ozarks at Large.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today we're joined with Julie Hall. She's director of the Berryville Public Library. Julie, nice to meet you.
Thank you, Pete. Glad to be here.
Give us a little history about the Berryville Library itself. How long has it been in its current place?
Well, the Berryville Library was established in 1938 in one small room. Today, over 80 years later, we're still a one-room library. We were last expanded in 1990. But that means we've been operating out of the same 3,000 square foot space for over 30 years. We're a busy library. We see over 75,000 visitors each year.
Wow.
So for a town the size of Berryville, which is only about 5,500, quite a few people are coming in, not just from Berryville, but the surrounding areas. We run over 500 programs. We have lots and lots of demands for non-traditional library services, like copiers, computers, of course, proctoring for online certifications and online exams. We just are out of space in our current space.
Y'all are looking into seeing what could happen with a possible new building.
Correct. We were very fortunate that the need for a bigger library in Berryville has been recognized. And just recently, the city of Berryville announced that they are willing to donate a piece of land big enough to build an 8,000 to 10,000 square foot library on it near the center of town. But unfortunately, our current tax support can't be used for the construction of new buildings, so we're going to have to raise some money. We have an architect who's working with us, and before we can determine how much money we need to raise for the building, we really want to hear from the community about what they think a new library building really needs to serve our community now and into the future. So we're having public input sessions on July 16th. An architect that we are working with will be there to listen to the public. We also have a survey that people can just fill out if people aren't interested or unable to come on July 16th. We really need as much community input as possible so we can plan a building that really will meet Berryville's needs.
And people can fill that survey out now, can't they? Where might they find that?
They can find it just by calling the Berryville Library. It's 870-423-2323 or on our Facebook page. Reach out to us there.
Julie, thank you so much for letting us know about this.
Thanks for having me.
91.3 and the Community Spotlight, where local matters.
Contributors for this Independence Day edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda and Timothy Dennis, who did some archival work to make sure this show was a possibility. Thanks, Antoinette. Thanks, Timothy. And I should mention that the Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF in the Carver Center for Public Radio. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Alma. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget tomorrow, some of our favorite musical performances from inside the Carver Center for Public Radio in the first 6 months of 2019. That's on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll end today with music from Daryl Shaw. Daryl wrote and performs the Ozarks at Large theme. This is his latest single, and it kind of fits into what we're talking about today, Landscape. It's titled A Walk in the Park. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. We'll be back with you with a musical edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow. I'm Kyle Kellums. Have a great rest of your Thursday.